joke. I had somebody in my office this morning, and a fairly new resident into Andorra, and I said, "What, you know, what do you think of Andorra?" And he said, "It'll be okay when it's finished."
Yes.
We've been saying that for 35 years since I first came to Andorra, and well, maybe it will be okay when it's finished, but nobody quite knows when that's going to be. I came here in Easter 1970 from the United Kingdom, travelling by car. And when I got to well below Paz de la Casa, the traffic jam. And it took 5 hours to get from just below Paz de la Casa to Encamp. That's Easter 1970. So nothing as much has changed. I don't think there's much improvement today, and I'll come on to that situation as I see it later on. Life initially was very simple, very uncomplicated, very peaceful, and very tranquil. It was a very simple country to live in. There were no demands made on anybody. Nobody rushed around. There was virtually no building going on. It was a very simple life, very attractive life in many, many ways. Things have changed a bit. That'll be a recurring theme in this talk. To try and situate you a bit, the population was 18,000. There were 6,000 Andorrans. There were 8,000 Spanish. 2,500 French, and 1,500 others, of which there were about 30 British at the time. When I came in this morning, just before lunch, somebody challenged me and said, "I'm here to make sure you don't tell any stories." I thought that was quite appropriate. But actually, there's somebody here with us today who actually knew me before I came to Andorra. So I can't tell any stories at all. some little bits and pieces about Andorra, just again to try and sort of put you in the frame. Bread was 5% of the loaf, petrol was 5% of a litre, diesel was 3%, a cleaning lady was 30% an hour. The first secretary I employed was 6,000 pesetas a month, and thought she was quite well paid. Land prices, which is a subject of some interest, I think, land in Earth was 10 pesetas a palm. In Aldosa it was 30. In El Plans it was 40. And in La Coma del Colas, which was the creme de la creme at the time, it was 50.
Wow.
No. These are all urbanized plots. These are all urbanized plots. The rent for an ordinary flat, a three-bedroom flat, including central heating, was 2,250 pesetas a month. And to buy an apartment in Encamp in those days was 500,000 pesetas, and the absolute top whack at the time was an urbanization which today is almost sort of hidden, called Jardi Valera in Andorra La Vella, and the best flat you could buy in the building was 1,500,000 pesetas. Car number plates were under 10,000, and there were no crash barriers at all in the whole of the best house. Not 1 meter. It was a strange place to come to. I came here really more or less by accident. I don't claim that it was part of a big plan at all. It wasn't. But there were a lot of eccentricities then, as there are probably now. In those days, they were probably a bit more extreme or a bit more eccentric than they are now. To post a letter, you had to go to the tailor's shop. Some of you, I'm sure, will remember that. It's not that long ago here in Amazon. Yeah. If you went needed a doctor in Lamasana, you went to the barber. If you needed a ski pass, and I'll come back to that in a minute, you went to the plumber in Leather Scalders. If you wanted a driving license, you went to what was then FASA and is now FEDA, the electricity generating station in Escaldo, where there was a very charming gentleman who liked to practice his English on you. It was really a test of his English rather than of your ability to drive. That was the way it was. And if you wanted a fishing license, he went to, again, to an iron monger in Escaldo. The Escaldo seemed to claim quite a lot of these, quite a lot of fame, let's say. There were a lot of things that weren't around. There was no undertaker in the whole of the country. The village carpenter just made, always had a stock of coffins to order, and you just got on with it and did the business, as you might say, yourselves, amongst yourselves. And here I tell a little story about an event which happened, I suppose, in the early 70s. The Hotel Rutland was a very meagre hotel in those days, and it had 3 stars, but it was only about a quarter the size it is now. And unfortunately, some British person had died in one of the rooms. And this was long before I was consul. So Antonio Garaglia rang me up and he said, Hugh, he said, one of yours has died in one of my rooms. What are you going to do? I said, I wasn't really very sure at all what I was going to do. Anyway, to cut that part of the story short, we eventually had everything set and running. We're having got hold of the local carpenter and had the coffin delivered and so on and so forth. And then I said, well, there you are. You know, it's in the coffin. He said, no, you can't leave it here. There's no question of leaving it here until the funeral tomorrow. You've got to take it away. So I said, that's a bit tricky, isn't it? So he said, no, I will stand guard between what was then the dining room and the bar. And when I say go, you come downstairs with your sturdy friends and take it away. I said, take it away where? Anyway, Dan Parsons, who many of you will remember, he had a Renault 16 sort of estate car. So he was harnessed into parking outside with the back flap open. And we got the coffin, so we carried it down 3 flights of stairs, and then we got to the sort of first floor landing, and then Antonio was sort of waiting to give us the signal to take it out. It was in the early evening, and anyway, every time we got to sort of within 3 or 4 steps of the bottom of the stairs, he said, somebody coming. So again. After 4 times, I said, look, this is not going to work. There was always going to be somebody coming. So eventually the head waiter and he sort of barred the doors on both directions, and eventually we roared down the stairs and across the hall and down the steps as they were then, and put this coffin into the back of Dan's estate car and said, off you go. And so he of course tried to shut the back of the estate car, but the coffin was too long, so it was sticking out of the sort of back of the car, and he shot off with the sort of back lid flapping up and down, and that was the end of the evacuation of that particular British subject. But it just sort of serves to illustrate how simple things were in those days. Well, no, you know, there weren't simply were no services, and very in a way, as a place to live, it was very, very attractive as a result. I'm going to touch on several points. One of them was immigration, a sore point for many of you. Immigration getting into the country is quite a job, but as some of you already know, one of you particularly who's sitting here today, getting out of the country is even more difficult once you want to go. It was a great deal simpler in my time. You just simply went down to the then police station, which was a tiny little office at the entrance to the Cousin Laval, with a desk and a little back office. That was all it was. And there you presented yourself with your passport, although they weren't that interested in your passport, but much more interested if you had a visiting card. So you put your visiting card down ostentatiously on the sort of desk, and the then chief of police, who was a charming man called Senor Daniel Amengol, whose son is the owner of this huge firm with all the diggers and trucks and everything else, and he gave you one of his visiting cards. It was just an exchange of visiting cards. So that was the beginning and the end of the immigration process. And on the back of it, he stamped here the date that you presented your card. I can still remember mine was the 6th of June 1970. That was it. There was no other formality at all. None whatever. In In those days, there were, the police force consisted of 8 officers. They had 2 vehicles. They had a mammy wagon, which was a long black Peugeot 404 estate car, and they had a Land Rover. And the Land Rover is subject to another story. In those early days, there weren't many discotheques. In fact, there weren't any discotheques. There were a few sort of nighttime bars, really. And then, I think about 1973, a discotheque opened. And it opened in another summer of all surprising places. And it was called Mule House, 1900. And it was in the basement of the building where today there is the Dia supermarket in the middle of Lamasan. It was run by a Cordino family, and it was an enormous success. But of course, inevitably detracted, some people having a good time on Saturdays. And so the Land Rover patrol car used to occasionally just turn up there on a Saturday night just to make sure that all was going well. And I was there that night, and the police had just recruited a new agent, as they called him, and he was sitting in the passenger seat on the right hand side of the Land Rover, and he was terribly proud of his pistol. I can tell you endless stories about the pride of the Trandoran police with their pistols, but anyway, this is the particular one I've chosen to tell you. And he was sort of, just as he was sitting there, he was doing his sort of Wild West bit. I don't think really anybody thought it was loaded, but of course it was loaded. Anyway, eventually he... I'm just turning it off. and he was spinning it around, and he was talking to some friends across the driver on his left, and he spun it around, and of course inevitably he pulled the trigger, and as he pulled the trigger, it fired, and the bullet grazed the top of the thighs of the driver, went straight through the aluminium door of the Land Rover, and straight into the thigh of the chap who was talking to him, who was a friend of his. So, they always say never trust police forces around the world. Well, things are a lot better these days, but there are lots of other stories. I will come back to that. I think we've got that. A little comment about frontiers. Obviously, you know, one tends to think of the frontiers here as being open all the time and convenient and so on. Not at all the case in 1970. The frontier with France was often closed in the winter. The Andorrans had a pretty tough time to keep open the pass. There was no tunnels at all. No tunnels at all at that time. They had a fairly tough time. And of course the French did what they could or what they should or perhaps what they shouldn't, but they didn't open it very often. But the Spanish one, surprisingly, was closed every night. It closed every night from 11 o'clock until 7 o'clock in the morning. So that was it. If you wanted to go out to Spain in the middle of the night, you couldn't. It was the frontier was closed.
A good idea.
And another thing that the Andorrans remember quite clearly, I don't know whether some of you will remember that about a couple of years ago, the Spanish reinforced the frontier patrols enormously and to try and clamp down on the smuggling. And there were actually they were first class people from the Spanish Douana service of the Douana, and they were basically there to stop the smuggling getting out of hand. And they did a pretty good job as well. I found people in all sorts of really strange places, but anyway, they were there, and there was a sort of ring of steel on the Spanish side 72 years ago. But I have to tell you that a few years back, they didn't do it like that. They just closed the frontier. In about 1967, the frontier with Spain was closed for several months. That was it. They just said, well, if you want to go on behaving like this, and do it on this. Do it on your own.
Good Lord.
So that's a little technicality. On the political side, of course, there was no government, there was no prime minister, there were no ministers, there were no ministries. There were very few civil servants. I'll come back to that in a second. The country was run in a very uneasy balance between the Conseil General, which was an entirely democratically elected council by the Andorrans, and of course two figures which we have forgotten already very quickly since before 1992 or 1993, which were these wonderful people called the Viguiers. They were, you know, it's an extraordinary thing to think of, you know, that here in Europe we still had Viguiers in 1992, but nevertheless it's the case. And you had one who was appointed by the French co-prince and one who was appointed by the Episcopal co-prince. And they had a lot of executive power, and they had control over the courts through the Bayer, and thence through the police. So there was a very ill-defined boundary, if you like, between what the vigiers could do, although they ultimately had complete power in Andorra, and what the Conseil General could do. The Conseil General were elected entirely by parishes. In those days there were only six parishes. The Scala didn't exist as a parish, it was all one of Andorra Vella. And each of the six parishes elected six members. So it was a very, very local sort of affair. Andorra, people have often wondered, you know, what was Andorra? Principality? What is Andorra? Principality? What was it? Well, I can only say that it definitely was not a sovereign state. You know, while you had lots of arguments, there are lots of sort of well-argued and learned arguments saying, well, it sort of was a sovereign state, but in fact, I don't think it was for a minute. The people that actually controlled it were the representatives in the country of the two co-princes, and a lot of people thought that the Episcopal co-prince looked after the, shall we say, the spiritual side of the country, and the French looked after the material side of the country. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the Episcopal co-prince was a man who had been appointed in 1970, and he stayed, the Episcopal co-prince is Vigier, and he stayed there until 1972. Francesc Badia, his name was, and he knew everything that was going on in the country in terms of material and other things. Whereas, of course, the French Vigier was a French Foreign Office appointee, so he only came every 2 years. And to be perfectly blunt, with all due respect to them, they had their hands in a sort of choke around a wonderful money-making device called import licenses. Because you couldn't import anything into the country unless you had a license. And the only people who could issue them were the two vigiers. So, you know, there was plenty of backhanders, if not worse, in those days as to who got the licenses. In the whole country at the time, there were probably about 40 civil servants, at the most. I'm going to go on to sport. There was very, very little sport, in organised sport of any sort in Andorra. You wouldn't think so now, with all the sort of sports complexes that there are around the place. But there were virtually no facilities at all, and it wasn't until 1993, with the Olympics of the little countries of Europe, that the whole thing started to take off. However, there were two sports here. There was skiing, and there was bullfighting. Quite active as well. Skiing was limited to two ski stations only, Pasta La Casa and Soldeo, and the only chair lift in the country was in Soldeo, so that was a big deal. Everything else was drag lifts.
This is just water here.
The whole history of how skiing developed in Andorra is a fascinating one and the subject of a completely different talk. But Mr. Villanomat, Senor Francesc Villanomat, was an Olympic skier. He was a Spanish Civil War refugee, and he got a sort of concession to develop the Paz de la Casa and Grau Roig ski area. Remarkable man, still alive. His son today runs the company. But suffice it to say that Grau Roig as a skiing area did exist, and indeed there was one very long drag lift from the bottom up towards the radio masts, which did link with Paz de la Casa. But there was no road to get there, so you had to walk from the corner of the pass, one of the last hairpin bend on the bottom of the pass. You had to walk across into Grau Roig to get to the ski lift, and obviously he was very keen to build a road to that ski area. And because the road goes across the area called La Concordia, which is has been until very recently a disputed area between the communes of Encamp and Canillo, 300 years the argument has been going on. He could not never get permission from both of them simultaneously. Because as soon as one said yes, the other said no. And vice versa. It was as simple as that. So on one occasion, on one afternoon, he had a yes from one of them, and he had a sort of, well, maybe, from the other. And Francesco did the match. Hired every machine, he had already set it up, of course, hired every machine in the principality, and by daylight the following morning he had built the road from the corner of the pass into Grauroch. That's the historical fact. Coming back towards Lavatana a bit now, all sorts of different points really. The road from Ertz to Pal was just a gravel road, there was no tarmac up here at all. And the roads between Nanyos and Aldosa and Cisboin and Els Plains were just narrow, very narrow tracks. The village of Lamasana started at the Hotel Lamasana, now defunct, and there was nothing at all, shall we say, on the Andorra Velia side of that. And then there was a big gap between the Hotel Lamasana and the Esso station, nothing at all in that area, whatever. I won't go on with all sorts of other details about that, but I do want to just touch on some things which I would call natural, or maybe not so natural, disasters. We had a terrible flood here in 1983. Some of you will remember it well. It affected us all very greatly. It could only be described as a major catastrophe. Once again, Andorra, I always say Andorra has the luck of the devil, and I mean it. There were very few people killed. I think in total, all throughout the whole country, I think there were only about 10 people killed. Here in Lamasana, it was greatly aggravated by the explosion of the gas depot, which is behind the Hotel Rutland there. The level of the river rose so much with water, and then with a lot of boulders which it was carrying down, that it flowed out of the bed of the river and into the sort of adjacent areas, the fields and the areas. And the rocks knocked off the purging valves on the bottom of these huge gas tanks, which released a vast cloud of gas, which nobody knew was there. Nobody knew it happened. And, of course, eventually, that huge cloud of gas found a spark. And it didn't explode as such, but it just was this colossal ball of fire. For a few seconds. I can remember it very clearly. It was a Sunday afternoon. I'd had lunch up in what was then the Asterix, that's disappeared under another natural disaster. And I remember the particular thing about it was the noise of the river. Not the water. You couldn't hear the water. It was the rocks being ground one upon the other. There was this screaming noise coming out of the river. It was quite bizarre. I don't know whether any of you have ever had the experience anywhere else. I'm sure it happens elsewhere. But the noise was the most upsetting noise. It was this tremendous grinding and screaming noise. The following day, that was a Monday, the water started to go down on Monday lunchtime. And on Tuesday, I walked down to Lamasana, which was like a ghost town. There was nothing, nobody there at all. Walked into Hotel Rutland, it was open. The abandoned meals were still left on the table. It was really quite the most bizarre experience you can imagine. There was nobody there at all. Because, first of all, having been flooded out of existence, they were then burnt out of existence by the gas. And I walked on down, I got a lift down to Andorra Velia, wondering what I was going to find. And I can remember walking up the Avenue de Merichel towards the Pyrenees and going into the Pyrenees and doing some shopping there. And, because we had no food. And it was the most extraordinary sight that the Pyrenees was absolutely, totally normal. There were the women there doing their shopping, so nothing had happened in their fur coats. There was this absolute calamity outside, and yet the Pyrenees was just a haven of normality. It really was very, very strange. I got a lift back up to Cisboin, and then I walked back to Ertz from Cisboin via Powell Village. We weren't allowed to go through Lamasana in case there was more gas that was going to burn. So it's a bit of a tricky place to get to Earth if you can't get to Lamasana. So, over the top, down here, down this road here, back to Earth, where I lived at the time. Again, it was an odd situation because there was water everywhere, spouting out of the rocks, spouting out of the mountain everywhere, but there was no water to drink, of course. no electricity. But bizarrely, the telephone worked for about another week until it was cut off. So that was really quite odd. But eventually, helicopters arrived with water and bread and milk and so on. That was quite a sort of welcome sight. And it was amazing, great compliment to the Andorran community, the Andorran society, I suppose, that they got the whole thing back. It was in November, and they got the whole thing sort of working again with roads with tarmac on the top by the 20th of December. In 6 weeks, they had re-established the country. I haven't brought along any photographs of it, but if you ever get a chance to see photographs of that event, it is absolutely dramatic how much of the bottoms of the valleys were just completely destroyed. The interesting extent, I remember, that they just for the first time put hot top tarmac on the road between Arinsal and La Massana, and they just finished painting the white lines along it. And in many cases, the road, literally, half the road disappeared. It was like a sort of postage stamp, but it broke along the dotted line and just disappeared. There was no, the other half had gone. And Val, you probably remember that.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary how that was the join, the sort of seam, if you like, in the tarmac between the two sides of the road. And this valley was very badly affected here. This stretch of road here between Powell and Ernst was very badly damaged. But that was one. The other one, perhaps, is the quarry collapse below the tunnels in October 1986. That was pretty bad. The quarry below where the second tunnel is, if you understand what I mean, the one with the concrete arches, that was a huge quarry, and the whole quarry collapsed from the top of the mountain all the way down into the road. Unfortunately, killed a few people.
Okay.
But that, again, had an interesting effect, because you couldn't get into the La Massana Valley at all. There was no road at all. So we all had to go across the road from Encamp, across Bacheliz and down into Anyos, which was a very tricky, muddy, single-track road. So it was one way for an hour, then the other way for an hour, then the other way, you know, so on. So alternate single-lane traffic with trucks, with cars, with everything. Mm. But again, the Andorrans managed to organise it quite well. So within about a week, you know, you felt, oh, this is all right. Pedestrians were able to walk by a hastily made path beside the river, the remains of which you can still see today. The avalanche in Arinsal, I know most of you, a lot of you will have heard about it and know about it. It was a dramatic avalanche. I don't know whether most of you realise just how dramatic it was. It was an absolutely gigantic avalanche by European standards. Again, I happened to be there that day. It was snowing very hard. I think if I remember rightly, it was a Wednesday. And just after 11 o'clock, a little tiny avalanche, well, not that tiny actually, but a small avalanche compared to what came later, came down across the road from the east side of the valley and blocked the road completely. And to begin with, there was concern that the 11 o'clock bus would have been caught in it. But fortunately, that day wasn't late, so we got through. At 12 o'clock, I received a phone call from the then mayor of La Massana, who was Antonio Garalian, in his first mandate. And he said, Hugh, you've got to take charge of evacuating all the British tourists above the village. And this was just, he might have been speaking to me in Chinese. I just had no concept of what he was talking about. Over the years, we've dealt with several avalanches and quite bad ones, and been up in the mountains, you know, with the probes and so on. But this was something completely and absolutely new. He said, "Yes, we have had, we've had a serious warning from the avalanche people here in Andorra that the whole of the Les Fons side could come down." So we started, and the entire police force and the whole of the fire department was ordered up there. And over the next few hours, we went into every single building above the village, from the apart hotel San Andreo upwards. And the deal was quite straightforward. You rang the doorbell, and if anybody answered, you told them to get their stuff together, they had 10 minutes to go. And if they didn't answer, the fireman came along, he smashed the door down, and he went around, and he looked around, and we smashed down hundreds of doors that day. We had completed the job at 5:30, and I can remember moving down from the San Andreo to the Hotel San Gotthard, where most of the people had been told to go as a sort of concentration point. And I then, de facto, had the job of finding 500 500 beds for the night for these people, which actually wasn't that difficult because it was the middle of the week. It got a lot trickier on the Friday night. And then there was a policeman standing beside me, and his walkie-talkie crackled into life, and I couldn't really hear what was being said. But that was at 6:10, the avalanche came down. It was completely dark, and the only thing that we knew was that the avalanche had been of such a magnitude that the jeep in which they were parked outside the San Andreo had been blown down the road more than 50 metres. It was mainly a powder avalanche, very fast moving, 200-odd kilometres an hour. The volume of snow was dramatic the following day when we got up there. It was actually, somebody said to me, it's 70 million cubic metres, and it doesn't mean anything to you at all. I mean, what does that mean, millions of cubic metres? We worked it out afterwards, and we divided it by the number of the large trucks that Mr. Armengol had, and it would represent a line of trucks nose to tail from Andorra to Barcelona. So it was a colossal avalanche. I mean, absolutely colossal avalanche. Afterwards, with the Swiss authorities and so on, we got a bit more information about it. But that's an avalanche of once every 50 years in Europe, that sort of volume. In terms of, when I say once every 50 years in Europe, in a built-up area. Okay? That sort of avalanche happens once every 50 years in Europe. In other mountain ranges throughout the world, it happens more frequently. And in the Himalayas, of course, it happens every year. But it was a gigantic avalanche. But when I tell you that there were no casualties at all, nobody was even hurt at all. Buildings were completely destroyed, wiped out. And the main bulk of the avalanche ended up in what was then the main car parking area for the Aransol car park. It came down at 6:10. That was the prime après ski time. The bars in that area were all stuffed with people, Red Rock, Asterix, the original surf, and so on and so forth. I think it's a conservative estimate. I think we would have had 600 people killed. I mean, nobody would have survived. There wasn't the slightest doubt. The pressure of the snow coming into those buildings was absolutely dramatic. So, it was one of the things, again, they have the luck of the devil in Andorra, and I really mean that. They do have a bit about now and the future, really. Well, more roadworks, more dust, more disruption, more concrete and tarmac. I have a fear that the public works already in hand, and by that I mean these tunnels and all these bits and pieces which are being built so slowly, it's almost embarrassing how slowly they're being built. I have a feeling that they're going to be out of date by the time they finish. I really think this sort of infrastructural work is 20 years too late. And I don't know quite where that will lead us. Certainly Andorra is a very, very different country. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work that out. It's a very different country to what even those of you who came here 5 years ago, you would have seen dramatic differences. I don't know what the answers are. I don't begin to know. I think this sort of triangular tunnel system around Andorra, Venia and Escaldes is probably a very good idea. Public transport has to be completely re-looked at. And whether they go for this aerial metro system or some other system, I don't know. It's there are not many choices. And of course, every time you build a road in Andorra, it costs a fortune. The airport in Sayre will eventually, I think, now come to be. I think it will. It's been one of the most painful processes I've ever known. I flew in and out on a scheduled flight into Sayre Airport more than 20 years ago. One of the few people that ever did, I think. We've got a general election coming up on the 24th of April, of course. There may well be big changes. I think probably the Liberal Party will get back in again, maybe on their own, or maybe with some sort of coalition. I don't think Andorra is ready yet for some sort of even very moderate socialist sort of left-leaning government. But maybe they'll be able to do it with some sort of coalition, who knows. As I said at the beginning, as somebody said to me this morning, it'll be okay.
Please ask
any questions. I'm very happy to have
you. Do you think about the airport as it stands now? The reason I ask is I flew in and out of it whenever it was, and I understand the reason it had to stop was the crosswinds on the one runway that they have. which was along the ridge, a ridge. Now they can't change that.
No, you're right. There are problems with the winds, but they can be to some extent. I mean, as you probably know, the original airport, the original strip, the strip that's there today, still there today, was built by basically knocking the top off two quite serious, I was going to say hills, but really one mountains, and dropping it into the gap in the middle. Sort of Inca engineering in that respect. And that worked quite well, but of course the cost of taking off a whole of both of the mountains was astronomical. So what they did was they left a great, huge chunk of one of the mountains. And you'll remember that you used to land beside this sort of cliff face, which is first of all unnerving, and secondly accentuated that problem with the crosswinds. Now the idea is that will be removed, so that it will be like a sort of giant aircraft carrier, really, like a deck in the middle of the valley. And I understand that's going to solve quite a lot of the problem of the wind, but it won't solve it all. It will be a very much weather-sensitive airport. That's for sure. There are all sorts of other problems as well in terms of ownership and who does what and so on and so forth. But I think sort of screening and, you know, it will come into this world. It will be brought into this world. I do believe that Seoul Airport will become a reality now. Just about a sort of, you know, critical mass to make it work now.
Any other questions? Please ask.
Have a good weekend.
Do you see Andorra ever becoming part of the EU?
I think I'm probably the last person to ask that. It has no choice but to negotiate some sort of deal. That's for sure. The Andorrans are well aware of that. The parties and political groupings of the left are very much in favour of that, whereas the Liberal Party, for their own quite clearly understood reasons, are rather against it. There are already agreements with the European Union. There are already several agreements between Brussels and Andorra, and I'm sure that those will grow. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But of course there is an awful reluctance on the part of the Andorrans to surrender certain aspects of their sovereignty to the greater good of the European Union. And I don't... I think it'll be a very long time before the dreaded word harmonisation takes place between the two countries. I think it'll be a tremendous long time. But you can see there's a tremendous reluctance for any sort of direct form of taxation here. And even the parties of the left, they say, yes, there must be direct taxation. But I think when the moment of truth arrives, I think they're going to be very, very reluctant to introduce it.
What sort of direction do you think the economy of Andorra should go? Because tourism surely is saturated.
Well, yes. Yes. I said that 35 years ago, when I spent 5 hours coming from Butler out of Winton. Yes. But I don't actually think that's the case. I don't think tourism is saturated. What has happened is that there are far too many people. If that's what you mean by saturated, then I agree with you. What we want is far fewer people, but far bigger spenders. And that's what we need. But it's going to be a long time before we get that.
IT or anything like that?
Well, yeah, they talk about all these things. They talk about trying to attract new industry into Andorra, and there are bits and pieces. But, you know, while there is such a strong law against foreigners owning the majority of a company here, or business here, and there is no answer to that. I mean, the only answer is no. It won't expand in terms of trade. I mean, we used to have to go through the tortures of the dam to try and get any sort of business going here. It's a lot easier now than it was even 20 years ago to start a business here. But this ridiculous, and I say that, you know, I do feel it is ridiculous, figure of having to have a pretnot, you know, a borrowed name in order to be able to set up a company or a business here. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And it's held the government, it's held the development of the country back dramatically, and thereby concentrated the wealth of the country into a tiny number of pockets, relatively speaking. It's a ludicrous situation, really.
Do you think the Andorrans, and I suppose I'm thinking really more of the young people, have any picture in their mind of how they want their culture to be or to develop?
I'd like to be able to say yes, but I don't think that's the right answer. I think everybody, as it has been the case in Andorra, I mean, what is Andorra? And you know, before the sort of tax-free and duty-free status of Andorra was realised and was appreciated, and it became a shopping place, which is only 50 years ago. You know, Andorra's been here well for a long time. This country was dirt poor. It had nothing. You've only got to look around at the old buildings here. None of the buildings have any architectural adornments at all. They are built in the simplest possible vernacular style. Why? Because there was no money. There was, you know, literally it was a roof over your head and that was it. And other similar places, I mean similar in other ways, but similar places like the islands, like the Balearics and so on. If you look around in the Balearics at times, they'd be immensely rich. Their wealth has waxed and waned.
As in Catalonia.
But in Andorra, until 50 years ago, there was no money here at all. Mm. Absolutely none. The result is that they have been very self-sufficient, very introverted, very independent people. When I say independent, I don't mean independent as a race. I mean independent as individual family units. Mm. And especially you still hear very often in Catalan, and it's true, is when you say, well, hang on a second, if you get to do it like that, you know, what about the rest? And the reply is, Cambridges, tell me what it is. In other words, they don't give a toss about the common good. And there is much more of a social conscience here than there was, although at times you have to look pretty hard to find it. And I mean that. There are far more well-meaning people here in Andorra than there were, but let me tell you, there's an awful lot of fiercely independent people still here in Andorra today. Is there a common image? No, I don't believe there is a common image. I think that's one of the biggest problems in Andorra. It was one of the biggest problems I had in the tourism business, was to try and say to people, well, what do you actually want? What do you want? Do you want to build more and more four-star hotels? Do you want to build more and more shops? Do you want to build more and more? Is it just numbers that we're looking at? Numbers of people coming in ever increasing numbers of coaches and spending practically nothing in the country in many cases and just bringing a picnic and then going out again. Is that what you really want? Mm. They have 11.5 million people a year here as visitors, of which only 3 million spend a night. Oh, it's a staggering statistic there. Councillor Valerie? I'd have to say yes, but I don't really think so.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel Andorra will look to the mini Olympic countries coming in? Are they going to finish some of these dramatic roads and everything in time at the end of May? Is it going to be as big a mess as it looks now? And how do you think their organisation is going to be? I mean, they're a bit involved and we just can't see it coming down. No, we're being ready for this influx and you know, we're going to be on show to the world or to Europe or whatever.
You're quite right. But I think that's also true about every Olympic city ever. I mean, Athens was being laughed at until the month before the Olympics started, and they said it's a shambles and they'll be ready, and sure enough it was, and they were a great success. They ran the mini Olympics, or the little countries of Europe in 1993 here, and I mean they were literally putting the stone facing up on the outside of the tennis centre in Aldosa up until the night before the first tennis match was played there. And they were everywhere. They were bringing in truckloads and truckloads of turf just to sort of cover up the building sites. And I think that's pretty much par for the course. But they did it. And in 1993, things were not at all what they are today in terms of facilities and make things happen and so on. You know, I go back to the flood. You know, no other country that I can think of in the world was so well equipped with diggers and trucks and excavating machines to make the roads, to put the roads back again. And Andorra was. They didn't have to import a single vehicle of any sort of machinery, of any sort from either France or Spain. They had none. So, be of good heart. Believe. Oh, no, I think it'll be alright. You'll be surprised. These things get horrendous right up until the last moment. But then,
are they going to overcome the parking problem of cars in Andorra? I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous.
Multiply parking costs by 10. And put some buses on. seriously, that I mean, you can't, I mean, you're using land which is worth zillions for open car parking. Look elsewhere in the world, there's no city in the world that's just doing that. It's just nonsense. But there is no alternative while there isn't a public transport alternative. Our problem here in Andorra is that public transport is not subsidised, it's a private company. And that's, you know, they have to make money. That's why there are plenty of buses between La Massana and Andorra La Vella, but there are three a day or four a day or whatever it is to Arisa. Because there isn't the volume to make it worth their while.
There's nobody on them.
Does the Catalan language help to slow down the business development to Andorra? Development to job opportunities and so
on? No, I don't think really, no. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in Catalonia speak Catalan, and that's where most of the economic impulse has been from. So I don't think so. Really, I think the legal structure slows it down a lot. I don't think Catalan does. I mean, most of the Andorrans now who are coming up into that sort of position, running companies and so on, they've nearly all been outside Andorra for their, at least their university education, if not more than that. So that, you know, the eyes are opening. The view on things is widening. There's no doubt about that. It used to be very, very narrow. Now it's there is a broader picture. And a lot of them come back